This is the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast for May 31st, 2019. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. What are we talking about today, Jackie?
Well, we're going to talk about investing in oil and gas, a topic that's near and dear to our hearts. We talk about it all the time.
Well, it is a hot topic, even in government.
We've got Jason Kenney, who was newly elected last month, but has recently opened up the legislature and putting in some new legislation. And one of his big goals is to bring investment back. And let's talk about the challenge that that is.
It is a challenge. Yeah, there's a lot of things going on. And we're going to talk about three things. We're going to talk about the current situation to understand why there is a dearth of investment in the Western Canadian oil and gas industry. We're going to look at those causes in greater detail, and then we're going to do a little bit of a future outlook and see what it is that we can look forward to. What are the remedies in terms of attracting money and capital back into the business?
Yeah, the hundreds of billions of dollar question at the end. So hold on to the end. That's okay. The one you're all waiting for. But let's start with the current situation. So, you know, I want to talk about the fact that, well, things are arguably worse in Canada when it comes to oil and gas investment. The climate in oil and gas investing globally is not that great either.
No. I mean, there's a big diversion even between American companies and Canadian companies.
Yeah. So I'm going to talk about a chart, which we will post on the site and put a link into our show notes. But it shows if you put a dollar into an upstream oil and gas equity index for the US and for Canada. So these are just upstream oil and gas companies. So they don't do refining or petrochemical, just purely producing
oil and gas producers. Yep.
And if you put a dollar in the beginning of 2017, you would be down about 20% if you had invested in the US. If you'd invested in Canada, you would be down about 40%.
Yeah, that's pretty staggering. Also considering that actually over the same time period, the price of oil has actually gone up by about 15-20%.
Yeah, in that range. And so, you know, the most interesting thing too is we've had a real valuation disconnect since the beginning of 2019 for both American and Canadian upstream companies. While WTI has rebounded from the lows of like $42 at the end of the year, it's up about 30%, even with the pullback we've seen in the last few weeks. The oil equities for both Canada and the US have been flat. They have not responded to the fact that oil price is up so much. Generally, in the past, if oil price went up that much, you'd see some increase in the value of the equities.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's like that proverbial tidal effect where if the price of oil, especially the price of oil in West Texas Intermediate, WTI, goes up, then there's general buoyancy and it lifts all the boats in the U.S. and the Canadian oil and gas industry. But that association between the tide coming in and the stocks going up is completely broken down, probably for over a year, but especially over the course of 2019, as you mentioned.
Yeah, I think that fall in WTI in the last quarter of 2018 really shook a lot of confidence from investors. You know, here after 3.5 years of waiting for a recovery, it lasted about a quarter, and then they were back to $40 again. And so even though the price of WTI has gone up, and really, the value of these oil and gas companies should be worth more. All things the same, the commodity they sell has gone up that much. Their cash flows are that much higher. They should be worth more as a company.
Well, and they are making money at the current levels of $60-ish oil. But you're right, that event, especially back in November, December of 2018, where the global price of oil fell and then we had our massive discounts here in Canada, has really rattled the markets. And that's why there is a dissociation, which has also led to a dearth of capital coming into both the US and the Canadian oil and gas industry from fresh capital. In other words, companies going out and borrowing more debt, as they historically do to grow, or importantly, getting more equity dollars from Bay Street, Wall Street, the big financial markets. If you look at it, I mean, in the US, it's really down dramatically.
It is. So it's not just Canadian companies that are having issues raising new capital, like debt and equity, as you say, but that's happening in the US as well. In 2018, they raised about a quarter of the typical level. Now, Canada raised about a tenth of their typical level.
Yeah, but I mean, let's put this a quarter of just actually a staggering amount. $75 billion was raised in the US in 2016. And like you say, I mean, it's just fallen to a quarter. What did you say, in 2018?
It was under 20 billion.
Under 20. Yeah. And then what about this year, year to date? It's almost nothing.
Yeah, almost nothing for the U.S. and almost nothing in Canada as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's very difficult whether you're in Canada or the U.S. to raise any capital. And that's resulted in companies not being able to grow or buy assets. It's really kind of frozen the whole industry.
Yeah, it really has. And I mean, I think that this is, I don't want to go as far as saying myth number one, but the fact that it is the lack of investment as a Canadian only problem, the lack of new money coming in. This is actually a big issue at large in the Western free market oil and gas equity markets, whether it's on the London Exchange, the New York Exchange, the Toronto Exchange, et cetera. It's just a lack of liquidity, which we're going to talk a little bit more about.
Now, I do want to say there's some exceptions to the situation.
There are.
And if you look at, and I just named three examples here, if I looked at the equity price of Shell, BP, and Suncor, and put them kind of relative to 2017, you'll see that Shell, BP, and Suncor have actually, so far in 2019, have been moving up as WTI has moved up. So while upstream-only equities have been flat, these equities have been reflecting the stronger WTI price.
Yeah, let's think about that some more. So in other words, the tide is lifting those boats, the BP, Shell, other integrateds, and here in Canada, integrated Suncor. In other words, integrated all the way from the wellhead through the refinery. And through actually even to the retail market and the gasoline
pump.
Yeah,
exactly, for all of these, that's true.
But most of the companies in the United States and Canada, what we would call the independents, they are purely producers of oil and gas.
And that's really what's reflected in that U.S. upstream equity. It's more of the independents, you know, in some like Occidental, they don't have retail or refining.
Right. So and, if you're big, you're integrated and efficient, making money, you're largely self-sufficient and the stock market is valuing you and they also pay out dividends.
Mm-hmm. And we talked about the Norway Sovereign Wealth Fund deciding to divest of upstream-only oil and gas companies, but they were okay with diversified companies that had refining and petrochemical because they felt that they would be more stable in terms of their cash flow as we go into maybe a lower demand world with lower prices. And they also valued companies with a foot in what they called the, like, the new world, whether it be new energy investing, not just oil and gas. So interestingly enough, BP and Shell especially, Suncor not so much in the new world, but definitely diversified. And so they might not be alone in valuing these companies differently than upstream-only companies.
Right, right. And I think that diversification within a company is important to recognize because, say, if the price of oil is low and the upstream part of the business isn't working, well, you make it up the difference in the refining and the midstream and the downstream.
Yeah, there's generally been a correlation. Like when the oil price is low, those sectors or those parts of your business actually do better because then they're buying the crude oil at a lower price and, and getting a bigger margin than they would normally.
Right.
And so it does create stability in cash flows, or it has historically. And so there's some logic to that.
Right. So good call by Norway. We'll have much more to say about that in a later podcast because it's kind of an interesting decision. But the point is that if you invested in these, you are being lifted up by the oil prices. If you're not, and most of the companies in Canada are not fully integrated because we have a very diversified ecosystem of small, mid-sized, large upstream companies. And then we have diversification in terms of product types, gas, light oil, medium oil, heavy oil, oil sands, and the whole smorgasbord of products. But generally speaking, if you invested a dollar, as we said, back in 2017 or even 18, you're not doing very well at the moment. And that's the investment problem that we're trying to understand.
Okay, so what are the drivers of why we are where we're at right now? And we wrote a commentary, Peter authored it, called Issues That Are Weighing on Oil and Gas Investment. We'll create a link to this in the show notes. And you outlined a lot of issues here that you believe are driving the lack of investment.
Yeah, there are. There's a lot of different issues. It's multifaceted, and that's why the government has a challenge. And it's not only up to the government, of course, it's also largely up to the industry itself to recognize the dynamic change that are happening in the industries. But let's just talk about, you know, point number one, which is probably one of the biggest points, and that is underperformance. I mean, this is an industry that for years, compared to other industries, has not really demonstrated compelling returns on their capital. In other words, relative to other businesses, they're not making money or not as much money as, say, real estate or technology or whatever. Well, some of these tech companies don't make any money, but they have a large
They've done well holding the stocks.
We'll leave that one alone. But from a, certainly from a resource peer perspective, or I would call it more asset heavy perspective, you know, because energy, oil and gas is a very asset heavy. The rocks are the assets. And so underperformance in terms of realizing a return on what comes out of the rocks has generally been poor. And investors have basically come to these companies over the last couple of years and says, listen, like you're not making any money. You haven't made any money. I want you to make money. The focus is no longer on growth in terms of volumes. The focus is growth on profitability. And that has really forced a sea change of mindset. I would say it's only really actually now in the last 6 to 12 months in terms of how these companies behave.
I think you're right. And it really ties into the next point, which is we're in a new era. We're calling it the supply abundance era. But, you know, many investors believe now that there's an abundance of gas and oil out there, whether it be Permian, tight oil, right, or shale gas in North America, and that you can't expect a bunch of price appreciation like we did back in the $100 oil era, where we believed there was limited resource. And so if you believe that prices aren't going to go up substantially, that they're going to be in a range, then you don't hold the stock and think that you're going to get your return by just holding it and waiting for oil price to go up.
Yeah.
Now you're saying, well, I need to get my return another way. And that's why you're seeing a lot of pressure for dividends and stock buybacks.
Right.
And so that you can get a return on holding that investment. And companies have to prove that they can create those returns even with flatter prices.
They have to prove it. But, you know, it's really quite interesting because the industry, as we've discussed in past episodes, is very much almost a victim of its own success. It's gotten too good at what it does. All the way up to, I would argue, about 2014, it was still an era of perceived scarcity, you know, still lingering from the sort of like peak oil era, we're running out, or the natural gas treadmill, we have to keep drilling more and more wells to get gas out. It's getting harder and harder and therefore more expensive. And then all of a sudden, the technological changes and the disruptions very quickly made us realize that we have gone from a period of scarcity to a period of abundance, where, oh my gosh, with the new technologies, you know, hydraulic fracturing, longer laterals, all the things that people in the industry know about, all of a sudden we can bring greater quantities out of the ground faster than ever and at lower cost.
Yeah, such a change. Like I remember going to big conferences and hearing the heads of many of these super majors, you know, back in 2012, 13, 14, and basically it was believed that there is no more cheap oil.
Right.
We need $80, maybe even $100 oil. We need to go to the Arctic and even the oil sands.
The ends of the earth. Yeah,
it's $100 plus going up. And now we've got so much more supply at low prices than you know, people would have never believed that could happen in such a short time.
No, exactly. And when the costs come down, the price comes down. And then the investors basically say, okay, now show me you can make money at these lower prices. But now it's happening, right? And I think that we're in this show me period. And it's probably going to last another year or two. And, you know, I'm sort of jumping to the end of the program. I won't give too much of a spoiler alert here. But if you can demonstrate that you can make money, self-sustain, and not be ongoing reliant on more and more equity coming in and diluting your shares, then all of a sudden, things change again. And we're in that transitionary period. But let's go on to the next point in terms of what it is that has been impairing investment. And I think this is a big one. We've talked a lot about it. And that's the issue of ESG.
Yes. Environmental, social, and governance, ESG. Mm-hmm. And, you know, really, I would say at this point, there's a real focus on the E, although I think that's broadening out now. But basically, looking for companies that have a lower environmental footprint, and carbon is definitely the thing that's really been focused on, your greenhouse gas emissions. Are you a lower carbon, more sustainable company in the future? Because there is a belief by many institutional investors that we're going into a lower demand world because there will be either policy or technology that starts to bend down demand.
Right.
And you want to be invested in companies that are more resilient. And to be more resilient, you need to be lower carbon.
Right. I mean, it's the whole idea we've talked about again many times in the past, which is better product, in other words, lower carbon intensity at lower cost. So those are the two dimensions that are really important. But, you know, the pressure from the ESG and the financial institutions is pretty acute. And a lot of them have a range from, I'm not investing in oil and gas at all, full stop, period, because I don't like your carbon and environmental footprint, all the way to, okay, well, we're going to assess and audit your environmental performance, your social performance. Social also, by the way, includes things like indigenous engagement, gender diversity, and a whole
safety.
a whole raft of social issues. And finally, governance. How are you governed in terms of your board of directors and how you behave in the communities and so on?
Mm-hmm. And there's more and more of these rating agencies that rate public companies based on that. And if you have a poor score, you may not get traded. And that speaks to another trend, which is the trading's no longer happening so much by individuals, but by computers.
Oh, I mean, this is huge. This algorithmic trading. In other words, basically a robot is trading the stocks of oil and gas companies on Bay Street, Wall Street, and beyond. And so if you score companies according to these metrics, the historical financial metrics are still in place, you know, cash flow, revenue, broad measures of profitability, and production growth and all sorts of other costs, et cetera, it would make decisions on whether or not it should buy your stock. But now we're into the world where all these softer scores matter a lot.
Yes, they matter. And even the hard scores, you know, if you're a company that's overspending your cash flow, that's not viewed as positive.
No.
That, by the way, was the history of the oil and gas industry for a long time. You know, for all the cash flow you'd make, it would all go back in the ground and then some. But now they're being very stringent. You know, like if you're overspending cash flow, if you don't have a good ESG score, you don't have the opportunity to go talk to a human portfolio manager and explain about your company. You know, the computers are deciding for you. So you've got to manage your business very tightly in order to continue to have liquidity and interest in your stock from that segment of the buyers.
Yeah, it is. And I think this point is really worth emphasizing because historically, in that peak oil era and remnants of the peak oil era, the focus was dominantly on growing production to fulfill demand that seemed insatiable, right? So grow your production, growing production. So the dominant, quote, score of looking at your stock, which was mostly done by a human, would say, are you growing your production? Yes, great. Are you making some money? Well, okay, fine. That's good. But it's really the production growth that was the number one thing. Now, it's as we said, it's not so much growing production at all. It's all about growing your profitability and improving your ESG score. And this is really important because some of these soft areas, the scoring mechanisms are not standardized at all, are they?
No, I mean, there are some third parties, not even public information, that publish ESG scores, and many institutional investors do subscribe to those, and then they use that information.
Yeah.
But there isn't consistency, and the numbers aren't all apples to apples. This is still really evolving. I think that would be a great topic for a future podcast.
No, we have to look into it. It's a little bit like your personal credit score, right? I mean, imagine most people don't even know what their personal credit score is, but then all of a sudden you go to apply for a loan and you find out that, hey, my score is no good. I think this is a situation that actually a lot of companies in the oil and gas space are increasingly finding themselves in. They don't even know what their scores are when it comes to ESG, but it's somewhere floating around out there. Yeah. Or they have no score whatsoever, which is an immediate X in the robot's algorithm.
Yeah, and if you're an oil and gas company that's not doing any sustainability reporting, then you're getting an X. And unfortunately, if you look at Canada, and we're going to look at this in a bit more detail, but many of the, especially the medium to junior size companies are not reporting, and so they're not getting any score.
Yeah, it's going to evolve, it's going to change. But this whole notion of understanding not only how humans are going to trade your stock, which are becoming in the minority because so much of stock market trading is becoming algorithmic, knowing what's going into the algorithm and ensuring that your score is good when you're doing a good job is going to be really important as you go forward. Okay, what are some of the other issues?
Well, many, I encourage everyone to read the article. There's a bit more detail on some other issues, but we'll just talk about, you know, those are generally the broad categories of issues on the global affecting all oil and gas companies. And then, of course, in Canada, we have our own unique issues, market access and other regulatory uncertainty, which is causing that Canadian disconnect that we will see if you look at the chart where, you know, we're down about 40% versus the beginning of 2017 in Canada here, where the American similar companies are down 20%. So there is a discount specific to Canada and things that could be solved in Canada that I think would help bring more parity between U.S. and Canadian upstream companies.
Yeah, and I think we've highlighted things that are contributing to the dearth of investment, broadly speaking, as Jackie said. But in Canada, there's a layer, a pancake on top of that. There's no question that our headlines vis-a-vis pipelines, and the market access issues, regulatory issues, and frankly, all the geopolitics in this country are just making investors shy away from the space. So to the extent that government and industry can come together to remedy all those issues, whether it's through policies such as, you know, an amended C-69 and those sorts of things, an approval on a Trans Mountain pipeline, it would go a long way to narrowing that gap, which really emerged, as you said, in 2017.
All right. Well, let's switch then to how things will change. We're kind of talking a little bit about that already. The big, big question is, when will things change? Why would they change? So I guess at the global level, I think of all those issues we talked about, I think the overarching issue is the supply abundance era and the investors trying to understand the new world and can they make money in this new world. And some caution that, you know, maybe companies can't make money at these prices and therefore I'd be better off to invest in the general market or other sectors. Now, we do believe there are companies, maybe not all companies, but there are companies that can do quite well in this $60 level-ish that we're in right now, but they need to show that over time and show that even with the ups and downs that occur, that they can generate sustainable cash flow for their investors.
Yeah, this is the key is, bluntly speaking, show me you can make money, show me the money. Mm-hmm. That's not just true for oil and gas, it's true for any industry. And now the metrics for measuring show me the money are different. It's, you know, show me your free cash flow, the amount of money you have left over that you could pay me a dividend. It's these sorts of metrics that are becoming more and more important. And the interesting thing is, as the industry comes under greater and greater pressure from investors and other externalities, it is actually adapting to this new world. But as you say, it hasn't yet fully gelled into the minds of investors that the industry, A, can make money, and B, can sustainably make money over a long period at a reduced oil price, which we think is probably long-term, what, it's probably in the $50, $60 range?
Well, you know, but the way to, and by the way, I think that's the thing, people aren't sure what that range is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we had quite a few years in the $100 oil era, and there was real conviction that there was a real floor on prices. They just absolutely could not go any lower than maybe $80, and there was just upside from there. Now, you know, especially with that fall of oil price at the end of 2018, I think there's a real uncertainty in terms of what is that range. And, you know, the way we looked at it is we looked at the days that WTI has been at each price level from January 2017 to now. And we chose January 2017 because we think that's sort of representative of the new era. Between 2014 and 17, we saw a massive change in the cost structure of the industry where, you know, it used to be that oil sands projects were $100 or $80 a barrel break even. But because of all the innovations that happened by 2017, people were talking about the fact that you could build an oil sands SAGD project for maybe $55 a barrel or lower. And same thing with the tight oil in North America, you know, big drop from believing it was, you know, an $80 supply source to 50. So I say from Jan 2017, because that's the new era. And what we did is we charted each day that the prices were at each level. And we found that 90% of the time, prices ranged between $45 and $71 at WTI with a median of $56. Yeah. So I do feel like we're starting to see that there is a range here that is evolving. You know, if we get above 70 or in that $70 range, as we saw in 2018, the U.S. brought on a lot of supply, 1.6 million barrels a day. So it wasn't able to be sustained. At the same time, we saw that when we get into that low 40s, and we talked about this on a past podcast, that even Saudi Aramco can't make money. So that isn't sustainable either.
Right. So we've seen a dynamic range in supply glut, supply deficit, dominantly induced by OPEC over this short two-year time period. And we've seen the prices go up and down within this band. But as I look at this chart, I mean, I think that definitely that mid-50s is probably that long-term price of oil. I just want to come back to this notion of 2017 as a starting point because it's so important. And it also relates to another reason why investment has been slow to come in, because 2017 is the year that the belief started to set in that this is the end of oil, because it was really a lot of excitement and hype and enthusiasm about electric vehicles coming in. Mm-hmm. And the notion was starting to gel in the minds of investors from Tesla and from all sorts of other quarters that technology is going to shutter the industry. And therefore, why would you want to invest in that? Those voices are still out there. But the charts really don't show that demand is going down. But, you know, we are of the belief that demand is going to moderate. There's no question. Mm-hmm. But if you are able to lower your costs and offer a better product, then I think even the Canadian numbers, if you look at the American numbers, many of the companies that reported in the last quarter or two can demonstrate that they're actually doing quite well at this mid-$50 range.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see when we see the results from the first quarter of 2019, when the prices mm-hmm. were in that kind of $55 to $60 level.
Yeah.
I think you're going to see some pretty healthy cash flow yeah. out of a lot of North American companies. I'm glad you brought up that electric car, because that actually was one of the other things weighing mm-hmm. that investment that was in your article that we didn't mention,
yeah.
was that psychological EV effect.
Yeah. And it's huge. And, you know, I've always said, well, you know, electric vehicles are not really making much of a dent in the demand for oil, which is a mind-numbing 100 million barrels plus. I mean, it's just such a staggering amount that has to be displaced. But psychologically, it is having much bigger impact on the minds of investors. And then the minds of investors then trickle through to some backroom programmer who puts it in an algorithm and some fuzzy scores. And then you get an understanding of why the liquidity in the space mm-hmm. here and in the United States has just really come off hard.
I think between 2017 and now, there's a greater understanding of the potential for EVs to disrupt the yeah. oil markets. We've done a lot of work, a lot of others, to show that even with an aggressive ramp up of electric cars, you're probably 10 years away from peak oil. And I think over time, people are going to start to understand that better. And again, I think that's something that will improve over
yeah.
the next several
yeah.
years.
You know, we don't dismiss at all the impact of those things because it does affect investment as we do. So where are we at?
Well, let's talk a little bit about the Canadian issues quickly. You did talk a bit about the fact that pipelines are potentially coming. I would also just say that I think there's a lot of opportunities for diversification of our market access here in Western Canada, and we have to show investors this too. But, you know, crude by rail is growing. There are opportunities to make crude by rail more efficient. We had Alex Pourbaix on our podcast mm-hmm. earlier in the year, and he talked about the ability to move potentially pure bitumen by rail and the fact that they were looking at that. And we had CN talk about the Canapux. So, you know, I think that's the other thing in Canada that will help. Yes, we'll get pipelines, but even if we don't get pipelines, I think you're going to start to see many different options for moving crude oil to market.
Yeah, this is really interesting, because what you have is a situation where all these pressures, the pipeline, anti-pipeline, and so on. And however you view oil, the reality is that all these pressures are forcing change and adaptation in the business. You know, the pressure of investors saying, show me, make money. Okay, well, the industry starts to adapt and shows it's making money. Okay, no pipelines, delays, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, let's think out of the barrel and think about how we're going to get this stuff to market. All of a sudden, you catalyze a whole new supply chain based on rail. We talked about that with James Cairns from CN several podcasts ago. And that stuff's mm-hmm. really triggering all sorts of innovation, which is worth repeating just quickly.
Yeah, Western Canada producers need to think out of the pipe.
Out of the
pipe.
There you
go, sit out of the box. But yeah, no, I think you're going to see some really interesting things over the next couple of years. I mean, I do expect we'll get a few pipelines as well, but I also think we're going to see more diversity, more optionality, and whether it be these partial upgrading technologies, which can basically make the heavy oil such that it can go in the pipeline without needing diluent, so basically frees up some space, to the pure bitumen by rail, the unit train loading facilities. You know, I think we're going to see more diversity, and that's good for Western Canada. We have to show it and prove it, and it may take a few years to get there. But I think at that point, we'll be very similar to the American producers. Mm-hmm. We'll have more stability and more sense of confidence that the crude can get to market and get a fair price.
Yeah. The next year to 2 years, I don't think we should misrepresent. It's still going to be tough. I mean, we're still in this period of adaptation. If you think about the 160-year history of oil and gas, I mean, it's been marked by all sorts of pressures and changes, whether they're environmental, social, political, economic, and technology. These forces of change have always force the industry to adapt. And what has happened over the course of the last half a dozen years is no different. In fact, I mean, it's mind-boggling amount of change in a very short period of time. And to think that you're going to adapt such a large industry overnight is folly. But the industry actually is adapting remarkably quickly to these things, whether it's giving the investors more of what it is that they want, or figuring out ways of adapting to new markets through new modalities. It's all happening. So what are we looking at? Like, the 2020s are going to be very different.
I think you're right. And I'm going to quote something from Peter Terzakian.
Oh, my gosh.
The write-up. But the last part of your write-up, you say, you know what, the formula seems pretty clear. Produce a better product, which is lower carbon. Show you can consistently make money for humans and algorithms. Make money more than others. Lower your costs and give investors their money back. If you can fill out this checklist, you are going to do okay. And this works in every industry, not just oil and gas.
It does. Yeah. Great. So, well, that was a fun discussion.
Yeah. Thanks for joining the podcast. If you like this podcast, leave a comment in iTunes or whatever app you subscribe to. We do read them all.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.